Hello, beautiful human. I'm Zach. That's Stanley. Yep. Welcome to the studio for the first time ever. Jacob Collier's here.
Hey. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You are you're really something else, man.
Hey, thank you, man.
You're a great energy. Thank you so much for giving us your time and your energy and your words and your wisdom. And I thank you for being here.
I so appreciate it. It's so cool to see. I've seen this room from afar for many, many years. And to be in it is surreal and great.
Welcome. That is, it gave me a little goosebumps. So thank you.
Cool.
Is it weird? God's truth. Like, can you tell me the first time you were validated by somebody you respected in the music industry? I mean, was it Quincy Jones? Was it Herbie Hancock? Like, who was it?
Well, I think my impression of the music industry changed because when I was a kid, the music industry was like my mom. It's like, oh, a musician, you know.
Which is real, genuine music.
Yeah.
And she was a professor and an educator. And it's
true,
rooted in your family, your grandfather, too.
Do you know these people?
A little bit.
That's crazy. as a kid, I thought the music industry was just musicians, just people who were making music. And so for me, like the most important validation was people who were just making really cool stuff. And so when I got to sort of 16, 17, 18 years old, and I started to make these videos from home, and then I got these emails from people like Herbie Hancock, right, and Quincy Jones, I was just completely beside myself because these were the people who were making the coolest stuff in the world. And that's what I thought the epitome of the music industry was. And then I sort of went in to discover that the music industry is this crazy complex web of different kinds of people who do different kinds of things. And so my impression of that has grown and changed. But at first, yeah, I suppose it was like Quincy and Herbie really that kind of opened my, well, smashed up my brain as a kid. It's like, how did you find these videos? I made these from home. How did you find them? You know,
do you, when you receive an email like that, do you ask yourself why? Do you try to dissect what you're doing that made them just gravitate towards you and reach out and then fly you, you know, to the States?
Right. Well, I think the first question I asked was who. It was like, which one of my mates is pulling a prank? You know, who's done this? And then it turns out it was really those people. And I think the question of why, I think everyone asks themselves why at different times in different ways. And I think I've sort of looked back at that time, maybe with slightly clearer hindsight than there was. I think at the time I was just kind of like, I'm in the adventure. I'm making the best, most beautiful things I can possibly make at this time. That's all I'm going to keep doing. And I think looking back now, there was potentially something in my intention, not to make music that wanted that was for other people to like, or that other people wanted me to make. It was more, I wanted to make things that I found fascinating. And I think maybe looking back, I'm the wrong person to ask maybe, but I think there was something about that purity that did cut through. And I think those two, I mean, what, Quincy's 90 and Herbie's 83, but they're like the biggest kids in the world, right? They're just totally open. Yeah, just like wide open, curious people. And I think that maybe when they heard that music, they thought, oh, this is something that feels non-competitive and pure and exciting and interesting. And I want to know more or something.
And real.
And real, yeah, maybe so. It felt real to me at the time. And I think looking back, it was real. Everything's always real in a sense, but anyway, yeah.
Why did you stop playing the violin? You gave it up only after 2 years. But you started really, really young.
Yeah, so I started violin when I was two. And violin's hard, man. It's like, it takes years to make a good note, to make one note sound good. You get that for a long time. So by the time I was four, I was like, I want more immediate results, you know? Like if you hit a cymbal, it goes, poosh, you're like, oh, result, or piano, bing, ah, cool. Or even singing, you know, shouting and singing, like hitting stuff. So as a kid, I was very kind of talkative with my hands, just like constantly. And violins just kind of like, I don't know what it was. I love them. I admire them so much. And the sound of my childhood was my mom playing.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Bark from downstairs, drifting up through the house, and just thinking like, this is what being a human is made of, you know. But it wasn't for me at that time.
So you realize at eight though that your voice is your greatest instrument?
I realized that I liked the voice, and the singing was the one thing I had lessons on as a kid, because I was kind of pretty much self-taught otherwise, and would just sort of garner materials for myself, kind of thinking, oh, I like this, and sometimes there'd be a teacher, or sometimes there'd be a friend, or I'd listen to a record and be like, this is how you do this. But most of all, I was self-taught, except for the voice. So I learned how to sing from my diaphragm, breathing properly, standing properly, delivering. And as a boy, I did lots of like opera productions. So in the UK, which is where I come from, there's like a big scene for, I wouldn't say necessarily a huge scene, but there's a world, a little orbit that boy trebles, we call them boy trebles, are a part of. So a boy treble is like when you're you're 12, sort of 11 to 13, and you have a voice up here, you know, and you sing these pure, notes, and something really, really special about it, really moving. And so when I was that age, I had the sort of honor of being a part of a lot of that stuff. So around that time, I learned how to sing, you could say properly, even though there's no such thing as properly for anything, but I loved the process of it. I never practiced, but I loved the process of learning in the lessons and experimenting. And I would always take something I learned in the singing lesson, and then I'd just interpret it in like some other part of music, you know, like electronic music or jazz or rock and roll, and be like, oh, I bet I can apply this to this. And I feel like I still do that a bit. It's like you can always take one skill or experience or feeling in your life and alchemize it to become something different. Because when you do music right, I think it's all kind of different dialects of the same tongue, like mother tongue, if that makes sense.
Well, 100%. And by the way, like you just tap into something that is like a much larger discussion, which is inspirations gathered from everything, and it dribbles into everything. But like there is something to, I know what you're talking about in terms of that boys choir, because they will still go viral every now and then, at least in today's age. Like they just name some kid who has this most angelic voice that hits this crazy pitch, and you listen to him sing, and it's just this, it's like peace. It's like it's this... You can't really describe it.
Have you guys seen that video where the boy like takes a whole balloon of helium to hit the top note? Have you seen that?
Yeah.
It's freaking so funny. But there's something about the boy treble thing that's just like, irrefutable and pure and like, you know.
But I understand how that could stick with you in terms of how you even process the human voice, but also how you choose to use that moving forward.
Yeah, so true. So true. I remember just being like, please can I have some low notes now? Like I'm done with the high notes. I want to get like, bah, you know, I want to go deep. And so gradually they came, like slowly but surely they came. And then I was like very excited, because then I could sing all the bass notes and the melody notes, and I could be the whole choir, you know, and that was a good moment.
Well, so when you listen to a song when you listen to a record, do you know initially that this is a song that you want to rearrange and make your own? Or do you only know... to fill something or to do something, if that makes any sense, right? Because you've won Grammys for the most interesting things. Like, you rearranged the Flintstones theme song and you got a Grammy. That's really incredibly fascinating. But is that something that, like, you do you know that that's something you need to rearrange? You have this yearning to do? Or do you understand what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah. I don't know if I have that kind of like a light bulb, like, oh, this is the one. But I gravitate towards songs with certain properties when it comes to arranging. So Flintstones is super memorable, repetitive. That's totally the key. You go, da dun da 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 dun da da da. That's basically the song, you know? You hear that three times, and you hear da 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 da, and that's the song. So,
you do so much with that.
That's the thing. I think what I love to do is I love to take material and squeeze it dry. Like, you reuse it, you go as deep as you can with it. I like to, we call it reharmonizing stuff in quite an extreme way. So unruly chords. I like them. I'm a freak for chords. I love them. And so with a melody like that, you can start with something relatively simple and you can evolve it into something that's like as deep as you want to go. And but a song like that is like it's like an anchor. It like grounds me. Because if there's no song to arrange in that situation, then there's just like infinite, you know? So having a song that's like simple, repetitive and memorable that I just love and grew up with really helps those ideas have ground. And then it's like something's, it's like there's roots. And then I can, like in a healthy way, I can stretch the plant or upwards as far as it will go. And there's tension between the song and me. And that's a handshake. That's a cool relationship. Whereas if there's no song, then I just kind of go off into the stratosphere and may never come back.
Yeah, because there's no guardrails. Like
that's the thing. Yeah. So I love these old songs. A lot of the best songs are old songs, honestly. I love those old songs where you can just take it for a spin, I guess.
I mean, okay, so Don't You Worry About a Thing is you rearrange that and obviously gets you the attention of, you know, the people who, Quincy and Herbie, like fucking crazy.
Well, that was the first one really that got to those people or got that, made that impression. And it was pretty weird because I was sitting in my room making these chords and making these rhythms that I just found to be on the edge of my own understanding. But I didn't do it for the reason of trying to reach these people. So it was really kind of like a serendipitous thing. And it's funny, your first question about the music industry is like, in my mind, I still thought the music industry is just the industry of people who make music, you know? And so for me, it was like I'd somehow beamed up and found these heroes. And then I got to hang out with them. And it was very, very surreal and very cool.
I mean, it's real recognizing real at the highest level and degree.
Mm.
But then would duplicate and replicate itself over and over again with the people you collaborate with. And the fact that you have a 4-volume project that is built with you and collaborators on a majority of the songs. I mean, that's correct. A lot of them are just you, but it is you and always somebody else working off each other creatively. And with that is validation to be vulnerable with one another.
That's the thing. So I made an album called In My Room. That was my first album.
And it gets you a couple Grammy nominations.
Crazy. That was a wild time. But I made that album completely in my room, in my literal room in London. And I toured that record with a one-man show for like 3 years. So it's just me on stage by myself with a circle of musical instruments. Bass, guitar, piano, drums, percussion, melodica. And then this custom-built instrument called the vocal harmonizer. There's a whole bunch of stuff.
But you built an instrument, correct?
That's the one. Yeah, the harmonizer. So
do you own a patent on that, or what's the deal?
No. Well, the thing about making maybe anything nowadays is that it pulls from many places. So parts of the harmonizer are real things you can buy. Part of it's completely customized. And I feel like this is true with music. You know, you write a song. And you're kind of pulling from here, here, here. You're constantly recycling, constantly taking things. And then you whittle them in and sort of alchemize them into your own form. But the harmonizer is like a mixture of hardware in such a way that it makes it difficult to patent it because it's not mine to patent. But I would like to build one day. That'd be a very cool thing to do. But all that to say, the harmonizer is like in the middle of the one-man show. Actually, it's still in the middle of the band show. But I got to the end of those 3 years. And I was like, man, I need to collaborate with some people. I got to figure some shit out. And so I did. I was kind of like, well, if I'm going to collaborate, let's go to the deepest and highest level I can imagine. Basically, I just wanted to learn music and therefore life from the best teachers in the world, which are my heroes. All the greatest people who are alive, in my estimation, who are making the coolest work, from the oldest to the youngest, you know? And so I embarked on this mission. I wasn't really sure what it was going to end up as or what it was going to represent for me, but I knew I was going to learn a bunch of stuff, and I did. And this is a classic Jacob move. I said, all right, it's going to be 4 albums in 1 year. I was like, this is going to be great. I'll release 4 whole records in 1 year. It's going to be so exciting. And then I'll just tour them all. And then obviously that didn't happen. And it ended up being kind of like more like one per year, you know? So I did. So volume one was 2018, volume two was 2019. Volume 3 was 2020, and Volume 4, which is the one I'm like currently finishing off and about to release, is going to come out in February, which is like a long time after. So it's been like a 6-year adventure, which is much longer than 1 year, but it was worth it.
Are you making these songs kind of in order in a sense? Like the songs you're making are getting released, or are you holding songs over from years ago that are now making their way to Volume 4? What's that like?
Yeah, a lot of the songs are being held over. There's some songs of Volume 4 that I wrote in my room days, you know, like really, really old songs. And there's some things I wrote like yesterday There's like a song already yesterday that will be on the album. So it's just a constant process. And the collaboration has been, yeah, it's just like vivacious because it's, like, for example, very, very different to collaborate with the Metropole Orchestra, who are from Holland, like a 60-piece orchestra where I'm writing all the charts out and I'm doing articulations and orchestration, to like Ty Dolla $ign, you know, who's just like this like veteran. Ty Dolla $ign's so, he's so sick, he's so cool. He's so super musical guy. But that's very different from working with like Oumou Sangare, like the Malian legend who like defines Malian music in the world in so many ways and is this like goddess of her culture, which is completely different from like Tori Kelly, you know? And it's just, it's like been so interesting to learn all these different people's language or at least absorb an amount of it. And I always think of it as kind of like building a bridge from my world and understanding, which I just want to keep on growing. It's like the main reason I did this, just to learn, but between my world and other people's worlds. And then so there's like a flow, like a channel that, where people can cross, you know. For example, I don't know if you guys have checked out Gnawa music, G-N-A-W-A. It's like Moroccan street music. And it's like hardcore. It's like, you know, it's mental. So beautiful. But there's something about the rhythm of Gnawa, which fascinates me, which, and a lot of music like this fascinates me, and it's because the rhythm is not straight, or you could say it's not quantized, it's not grid-based. So you're not like techno, it's like everything's like a computer, grid, like maths. Gnawa, which is a bit like samba in a sense, is wonky. It's like... you know, or samba, which is like, you know, it kind of has, it's like rolls like an egg, like, and it's so beautiful. Jay Dilla does this, hip hop does this. And so I realized this like about 10 years ago when I was like falling in love with Dilla, D'Angelo, and Questlove's drumming and all this stuff. It's like, wow. So it's the same as, but they're from such different parts of the world. And so one of the things with this album was like, what if I could build some bridges just for myself between the way that I hear this and the way that I hear this? There's the same language, but no one's talking about it, you know?
Oh, that's really fascinating. Mm. Yeah, because it is totally the same, but yeah, it isn't.
But it's different as well. The thing about, I would say the thing that those two things have in common is that rhythm, so you could say music can be defined by three basic forces. There's rhythm, which is basically the body. There's harmony, which is like the relationship between things. And then there's melody, which is like the voice, like the character. And rhythm has always come from the body. And there's a crazy myth right now in like in music education, which is like, you know, you learn rhythm from a book. You know, you read a book and it's like, right, you can count up and you can subdivide and you can all these terms and technicalities that mean nothing, you know? Rhythm is... Are you grooving?
Yeah.
So the funny thing about samba, I'm trying to, is there like a something I can shake?
Oh.
And we've got like a box of mints or something.
I don't know. Do we?
Let me see.
Actually, I think finally maybe I have one in my green bag.
We definitely have mints in the green room.
This is actually a fun thing to demonstrate.
I'm excited.
It's outside the room.
We're gonna find mints.
Yeah, okay, we can find. I also kind of like want a mint, so that's like
some in the green room.
Secondary request.
So while we wait for the mints, how does this, Gnawa, that's what it's called, right?
Gnawa.
How does that even cross your path?
I can't remember. I think I was just on YouTube, probably just sort of goofing about when I was about 17 or 18, probably 18, 19. And I was actually at that time studying at the Royal Academy of Music in London. I was studying as a jazz pianist. And jazz piano is cool, but I was kind of there to learn as much as I could about loads of stuff. And there was one teacher whose name is Barak Shmuel. He's a really good friend of mine. And he's like just like a rhythmic guru. And so in my first year, I actually attended all four. It was a 4-year degree, but I only went to like 2 years of it. But I attended all 4 years worth of classes in the first year because I was just so freaking interested. I was like, give me everything. And that like it would be a 3-hour class where the years were coming out. I'd stay for the whole thing. And then I'd like take Barak to lunch every single Friday. I'd be like, right, I'm going to get you beans and chips. We call them fries. We call them chips. You tell me about microtonality, you know? Like, tell me about negative harmony. Tell me about swing percentages. So swing percentages, it's so nerdy, but it's so fun. It's like the idea that in jazz, right, you have any kind of music, you have a percentage of group, of like a percentage of swing. So like 50% is like, right, even. 66% is like, because you think it's like 66% the way to 100, right? So 50 is like and then 66 and 75 80, you know, gets steeper and steeper. And so this sounds kind of like, you know, cerebral, but actually in music that you will know, it's like there's just different kinds of swing. So I was like, Barrick, tell me about swing percentages. And he told me a lot about like groove ratios, the idea that you can have it like samba being something like, you know, 3-2-2-3. It's like a kind of little equation that it, like, you know, Brazilians don't give a shit about that. They just think about, does it feel amazing in my body?
No, it's the studying of it that breaks it down in this way. But yeah. Do you apply that mathematical approach to the way you make music still?
Well, it's more like as I'm deepening my fascination, I will figure out, oh, so you can think about it like this. And then you forget all about it. Just make music that you want to make.
So what do you see when you hear something or make something out of nothing?
Well, there are different axes of hearing stuff, but the swing percentage thing is interesting because it's like a little graph of like, oh, it's like a shape that the rhythm makes in your body. And so, yeah, with Gnawa, that's a particular pocket. It's like a particular feeling. And it's fun, not because then I end up listening with my brain, but just because my brain gives my ears access to a feeling, and then I can play with that feeling and create things in and around that orbit. And I also, it's a bit like understanding grammar or spelling. Yeah. It's like when I'm talking to you now, I'm not thinking about grammar or spelling, but the fact that I'm familiar with them to the point that I am helps when I'm articulating certain things in stop time. And then in real time, I just flow, you know?
It's very much unconscious.
It's very much unconscious, but I enjoy the process of hopping between the total chaos of like the unconscious and then the sort of careful consideration of like the sort of steady hands of ideas that you can hop between and believe in. And I've always found both sides of that in music very, very interesting, because music is such a big and open field. And I didn't get into it because I cared at all about music theory. In fact, I really hated music theory till I was about 18 or 19. And the reason I started to like it is because I started to make up my own words for stuff. You know, I'd like invent my own labels for things. And that's, again, quite a sort of Jacobi construct as a kid. But I didn't really like using other people's structures very much. I would much rather make my own one and then build a bridge from it to somebody else's. So this is kind of how it's gone with a lot of things in music, but I came to the sort of science and alchemy, like mathematics of how music fits together, kind of late on, though my brain was always interested in the feelings of it. It's like, oh, but you can reverse engineer the way this F minor chord feels. It's like, why does it feel warmer than this one? Because it has a B flat in it. Oh, you know, and then you start to learn, it's like recipes. You learn recipes and you're like, oh. And I would just spend so many hours sitting with these musical things, chords and stuff, and just feeling my way through them like, blind, you know, wow, you can go here, and then sort of finding a way to sort of encyclopedia-ize, if that's a word, like these concepts and feelings in my own mind, so that when I sit on stage, like last week at the Hollywood Bowl, and improvise on the piano, I'm drawing on all these different things, and I don't have to think about it too much, you know.
But that's from, I mean, that's tens of thousands of hours of studying, learning, applying, creating. I totally understand it.
Mm.
By the way, we have mints for you.
We have a box of mints there.
Okay, first things first, I'm going to eat one.
Yeah.
And then I'll demonstrate this samba thing, and then we can move on.
Oh, it's wrapped.
You guys want one of these?
Maybe.
I'll take one afterwards.
Okay, yeah. That's fair enough. This is kind of full. Okay, I'm going to like empty it out half.
Yeah.
This is going to be worthwhile. Where's the camera? This is going to be worthwhile.
You can just like throw them on the floor or whatever.
You know, this guy's super hungry, man.
For the cat.
Just leave him there for that.
All right. She smells.
I'm going to explain this while I'm eating the mint. This is quantized. This is grid-based rhythm, right? Rigid, structured. If you do this for 4 hours, you get super tired. So what's a way you can do that in a more sustainable way for the body? Well, the Brazilians would say you move your arm half the number of times and you let the wrist do the rest. So you go, instead of arm, 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 you go like that. And that's samba, right? So you can do that for 4 hours and it's less tiring. The body gives you solutions to things. And the same is true with Gnawa. You know, they have these metal castanets called karakebs. And they kind of lock together in these weird ways, but the body tells you what it needs to do. So I don't think people thought like, oh, you know, let's have music that's not straight and any kind of theoretical thing. They just thought like, I want to do this for a long time, and gradually the body kind of figured, I think this is my theory anyway.
Yeah.
And that feels really good. That's such a good feeling, you know?
That's fascinating. Because it starts with physicality, right? Everything starts with a groove. Everything starts with like, I don't know, dude. Human nature is like pretty wild. The body's insane.
It's crazy. One other example of this, and then I'll literally stop. Because I could go forever. But waltz, the classical waltz, right? We've all heard waltzes. Waltz feels great.
You feel it more than
you feel it. Yeah. So in the dance of the waltz, if I'm not mistaken, the weight of the step falls on the second division. We call that a three division groove, right? Dum, 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 one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. But the step goes one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, dum, 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 which is just so sexy because it's like means that the rhythm doesn't go dun, 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 dun. It goes dun, 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 dun. It's like it like orbits itself. Every beat is like it's like gravity. It's like the moon going, you know. And so because of the step, the music just had to bend. Like music, you had to bend music to suit human beings. It's one of the troubling things about 2023. And there are lots of great things about 2023 in terms of making music, but I think people are making music to conform to the technology. And that's so problematic because historically, forever and ever, not just music, but the whole of language has always bent where necessary to sort of examine or exaggerate parts of the human experience. And so the fact that the human experience is being kind of like buttoned up for, you know, these algorithms or the whatever happens to be, these systems, these instruments, these softwares, you know, technologies, apps and stuff, I think whilst it's extremely connective and exciting, it's also kind of terrifying because that's not the right way around, you know? Like humans need to be humans, and then the language that we operate and communicate with needs to be bendy and somewhat made up, you know? Really? Like I used to spend a lot of my childhood like just making up words to express things, you know, like, because sometimes if you make up a word, it's just, it says it better than a real word, but in the world of like autocorrect and spell check, it's like, that's not a word, you know?
True.
But that's the same with music, same with everything else. It's tricky.
Well, it's limiting ourselves to fit some other mold that we have no control of.
Yeah, exactly. But I think we do have control over it. But I think the people who want to stretch it don't necessarily have as easy a time as they used to.
I understand
in making those waves.
Well, every artist is falling victim to this idea that the platforms or the lines of distribution to the people are algorithmic based.
Mm.
And
yeah, the last 5 years, it's completely changed. You know, it's wild.
Well, because it is frightening. It really is, because ultimately what it's doing is like making people feel like they need to do something to reach people, when the reality is like, you know, how many times like have I said it just in like the last week, is like a great song is like a tennis ball underwater. Like it will always rise to the top. It will always find the people it's meant to be heard by, but you'll never know it unless you go in with the right intent.
Mm. But like, well, I think a lot of it falls on these tech companies, honestly, you know, what their priorities are. And I get it, you know, they want to make money. They want to have eyeballs. They want to maintain eyeballs and things like that. But the tricky thing about that is it's so unsustainable for the culture of creators. And a lot of these platforms say, well, we're very creator friendly. But the reality of what that means they would need to do some thinking about how those tools are being used, especially with AI now too. You know, a whole bunch of the influx of a new kind of intelligence. But there are ways of using this stuff to help people make cool stuff, you know, and inspire people that things are possible. But it's interesting, you know, I think of myself as a young artist. I've been making music in the industry, you could say, for about 10 years now, 9 years. And when I started, YouTube was this kind of it's not open source, but it was just this open field. It was kind of like, you know, anything goes, man.
It's true.
And there weren't these kind of rigid algorithms in place. And, you know, the fact that there are algorithms means that sometimes I have videos that are served to, you know, many millions of people that probably wouldn't find it otherwise. But it also, I think what I find troubling is that the climate of creators, like there's this kind of like blinkers that go on the creative process. I worry about this most with young artists. You know, like for me, I think I came up in a time where I could just focus on my ideas, just making the stuff I found most fascinating and not trying to, I wasn't trying to sell myself or sell a product until kind of fairly recently, I suppose. But like for 20 years before I started my career, I was just messing around, which is like a really big blessing. But I worry about these, you know, 15, 16 year olds or even younger people who are kind of like, oh, I want to be a musician. Yeah, that's cool. How do I get started? Oh, I go viral, you know. That's devastating to me because going viral by default is like, it's you're succeeding in conforming to something, and the most vulnerable and interesting ideas don't always play in that field. They can do, but I think it's just, it's a dangerous time to make assumptions about who you are based on the kind of influx you get from other people's validation. I mean, you must feel the same way. It's like in every facet of what we do.
Oh, 100%. And but the other thing too is like, it destroys me because what ends up happening is really genuinely talented people never get their day. And and I also think that like what used to be A&R departments at record labels that used to go out and develop talent from seeing somebody with potential and opportunity and like being able to fill a void that has yet to be filled by other artists, like that's gone. Like, you know, unless you're going viral, nobody's looking at you.
Yeah, it's so tricky. And it's about risk, you know, and I think a lot about risk and live a lot about risk, you could say, because as a musician, you have to be able to, you have to be able to take that leap, you know.
Totally.
And artists have to be allowed to do bad work. That's the other thing. Like they have to be allowed to go through bad periods where they just don't know what's going on. Because in what world are you constantly inspired? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So I think the constant experience that artists have of kind of like, compete, win, you know, I think it's hard. And I think, I also think in a sense, it would be a myth to say that this is a new idea. Like there's always been an idea. There's always been a concept of the masses, you know, the gallery, you know, and there's always been a relationship and a tension between artists and the public and the audience. You know, that's existed since the dawn of time. And so it's not new, but I think it is exaggerated. And I think because of that, just it's the more artists can sort of talk about it with each other. Like I can't think of a single musician out of the 60 collaborators on this project, this quadruple album project, that don't feel this in some way.
And which is crazy because it's felt by everybody.
Yeah. Whether you're a world-dominating leader, titan, or whether you're like a total novice, everyone's insecure, you know? So it's, and that's okay.
I find peace in that.
Me too. And it's normal and natural. And the fact that you're insecure is not your fault. I think that's a huge thing. It's like you being insecure about this stuff is not your fault, but it is your choice as to how you interact with it. And I think the more people are aware that there are ways of creating that don't conform to this, that still are of meaning in the world, the better.
How do you, I'm assuming there's no one way to start a record, but is there in your process? Because when you bring things to collaborators, are you bringing something or are you starting it with them?
It really depends. I normally walk in with something, and that something can be really, really simple, like a chord progression or a beat or a little melody or a hook or just a sound world or whatever. But there have also been times where I've just like with Tori Kelly, for example, we wrote a song for Jesse Volume 3 called Running Out of Love. And that was, oh, thanks. And we just walked into the room. This in 2017 we wrote that song. It's crazy, so long ago. We walked into the room in Hermosa Beach, not far from here. And we were just like, I think I had like, dum, 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 dum. Dum, dum. And that's all I had. It's like, oh, I've got one note and a beat, you know, a kick and a snare. Tori comes in, being the boss that she is, she just spits the words. It ain't always easy. I was just like, all right, where did that come from? And she's just riffing. That was amazing. But then there are other artists who really enjoy kind of like being told, hey, this is an area that you should maybe start here, you know, or okay, here's an idea I have. And so one of the things I've learned over the course of the last 5 or 6 years is like how to get the best results out of all these different people. You know, somebody like Hamid El Kasri, who's actually a Moroccan Gnawa legend. I flew to Casablanca by myself in 2018. It's pretty scary. And I was just told like, hey, come to this hotel room, knock on this door, and he will be there. Hamid El Kasri, like the greatest living Gnawa musician. Because I'd been like fanboying over Hamid El Kasri for like many years. Sent an email to his team, didn't hear anything back for like 3 months. I was like, okay, well, obviously there's no way I'm going to get to Hamid El Kasri. And then he emailed back, knocked on this door. There's Hamid El Kasri with his tiny, like really, really thin, long pipe. I don't know what was in that thing, but he was just like super present, down to go. The next day we went to the studio, doesn't speak a word of English, right? And so the way I communicate with that is so different from the way I communicate with, you know, like Daniel Caesar. Because with Daniel Caesar, we just hang out, talk about life. You know, Hamana Castri, I'm talking symbols, I'm talking, you know, expression. I was like, oh, you could do, you know, using my body. And it's just, it's a beautiful thing to explore and explain that. And, you know, but working with like Voces 8, who's an English choral singing group, going back to my roots, you know, for them, it's like write everything out on paper and write the dynamics, you know, all that stuff. And so it's just different languages, you know.
Is there anything that connects everybody?
Joy, actually. Joy. If you make an environment of joy, it's infectious. It's like, oh, cool, you know. And with joy, with real joy comes permission. Be yourself. Be who you are today. Don't try and make yourself into something that you're not. And I think a lot about permission now, man, because it's like it's becoming a bit of a key word for me. I've long been fascinated by the relationship between audience and performer. But in the last few years, I've been sort of conducting my audiences in 3-part harmonies and stuff like that. And
you do a great job.
Thanks.
It's really exquisite.
Oh, cheers.
Yeah.
It's been a process of learning, but ultimately that exercise is not musical. That exercise is about permission. It's about saying, you can do this, go.
It's psychological.
Yeah, it is. And obviously there's an amount of music in it, you know, and it helps that enough people in the audience tend to know what's going on, but my job is to make it clear. I don't say a word. I never utter a note or a word. I just go, go. I give them like a starting point and I say, you go. And so permission is just become this huge pillar in my psychology, the way I think about my what I'm up to here, what my purpose is as a human. Giving people permission is one of the biggest things you can give people. It's bigger than a compliment. It's bigger than an idea. It's bigger than something of monetary value. And it's bigger than even just like me being me. You know, I could be like, I'm really, really me, but giving someone permission to feel what they want to feel or feel what they do feel is a huger and vaster and more deep goal. And you can't really decide to give someone permission, but you can give yourself permission to be vulnerable and to topple around and be who you are and be clear. And if you just focus that beam, I'm finding the results are really profound, like really emotional and connective in a beautiful way.
And it's come out in every song that is a collaboration. But how do you allow yourself permission when you're alone making music? Or are you ever alone making music?
Yeah, well, I started my journey completely in solitude, and still now we'll do a lot of the deep work, you know, mixing, because I mix all my own records and I go in really deep on it. So it's like, and you know, I've sat with other people, collaborators. One of my really dear collaborators is a guy called Ben Bloomberg, who built the Vocal Harmonizer and stuff, and his ears are amazing with mixing. He's helped me a lot, but fundamentally that work really happens when I'm by myself, because no one wants to be with me when I'm like, you know, it's just like I go into such a zone on it all. And so, yeah, it's the constant balance between solitary time and communal time. And that's where that bridge is where the magic is born, I think.
How do you know when a song is done?
Man, I don't think I've ever finished a song. I think there just comes a time you have to put it out, you know, and then it just keeps on evolving after that.
Is it hard to hear it after that then?
No, because I wouldn't release a song unless it's reached a point where I'm like, okay, I'm comfortable with the forces at play here. Like there comes a point with a song where you're like, okay, that's cool, and you'll always notice things later, like that one note, that I could have nudged, you know. But at the end of the day, like, people aren't moved by things that are perfect. People are moved by things that are human.
Amen. When you're building out this larger story that is a 4-part story, and you're pulling song like. What I found really interesting is that you're pulling songs that are older and also a song you wrote yesterday is making this new album. What story are you trying to tell within this volume? And like, how are you curating? Is it based on that, or is it based on Sonics? What is it?
It's a whole mixture of stuff. I never really set out to make a record with a clear idea in mind. Like, right, my goal here is to say this, but one of the things that's made this particular album very exhilarating and also intimidating to finish has been just like the sheer capacity of what it could be, because this is like the culmination of my entire learning, really. Like, it's a massive piece of work and has required a deep amount of attention. And I think that the arc of that journey kind of, it begins by throwing all the paint, like what could we go? Where could we go? Where could we go? And you end up with a few things that you really like. So, you know, like I released a song actually last week called Little Blue, and that song was one of the first songs I wrote for the album. And when I wrote that song, end of 2020, I wrote the verse for that song. It took me 3 years to get to the chorus.
Wow.
But I was like, right, that's one of the North Stars for this album. I like the feeling of this a lot. And then I wrote a few other songs that I won't name yet, but things that are kind of like, oh, that feels good, that feels good. So now it's just about joining the dots. And
why did it take you 3 years to finish it?
Man, that song, it haunted me, you know?
What happened in your life? I mean, besides the most.
Well, the intention that I went with that song at first was a traditional intention, which was like, right, the verse is quite tender and soft. And the chorus, I was trying to get a big chorus. So like, not like a big, like a kind of like famous chorus or popular chorus, but more like a dynamically large chorus. So the verse is sort of in its own world. And then I wanted the chorus to go up. But normally that's what choruses do, right? It's like, oh, chorus and chorus. And that's why I must have tried 10 choruses, man. Like just trying to get big. I tried changing key. I tried staying in the same key. I tried going low. It just never hit. Until one day, about 8 months ago or so, I was walking home from the dentist. And it's like a great walk. It's like a half an hour walk. It's like just in the sunshine. And I just had this idea for a melody that I didn't think of as being part of Little Blue. I just thought of part of being its own thing. And it was like, don't be afraid of the dark in your heart. You're going to find a way. Don't be afraid of the light. It's all right. All the stuff. And it was really small. It was even smaller than the verse. And the verse is small, you know? And I realized a couple of weeks later that was my chorus. It's like, it goes down. It goes smaller. And I actually think, you know, you say what was going on in your life. I think I was actually learning at that time, and I'm still learning sometimes how what an increase in intensity it can be to do less. And that's like an interesting predicament, because I've always been the person who does a lot. I'm, you know, multitudinous. I'm very much am through and through. But I do think that there becomes space for more dynamics when you kind of choose your key elements and then let those things swell and grow.
Totally.
And I like even just like my schedule, you know, I was doing like 50 things a day. And then there came a point where it's like, maybe if I do 10 things a day or 20 things a day, those things can just breathe better. And and turns out they do. I also think that's part of just growing older, you know, but that song was a reflection of that process for me. It's like, okay, so maybe bigger is actually smaller in this context.
Less is more.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say less is always more. I think I was often told less is more as a kid, and I was just like, really? How do I know that if I haven't gone to the more? You have to go and check out what more is before you know that less is actually more. And actually sometimes more is more, but often it's somewhere in between. You know, often you can have less of one thing, which leaves space for more of the other. So rather than like universally scale everything down and then that's just more, it's like you remove one thing and then it's the same amount of space, but but that space can be filled with a different kind of thing, and it can be much more balanced in that sense. And so, yeah, this song really taught me that in a deep way.
Is it done by the time you bring it to Brandi Carlile, or?
It was pretty much there actually on that particular song. It was in a place where I was singing both verses, and I just thought like, I'd love to have like a counterpart vocal to me on this song. And I love Brandi Carlile. I think she's just an amazing force of nature and a really dear friend of mine. I just asked her, and she was like, yeah, I couldn't believe it, you know? And she sent the vocal in really last minute. It's about 2 weeks before the song was delivered. And she just came in, and I thought, this is the song. And it's found its muse. It's amazing.
The song's incredible.
Thank you very much.
Really, really special. And like, really, and one of the best I've ever heard, honestly. Again, I heard it first live at the Bowl, and then I've been listening to it ever since.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Really something. Is there any truth to the belief that a great song is still great when you strip everything back and it's just the song on a piano or on a guitar?
I think that idea is quite old-fashioned, but I believe an amount of it. I can think of many musicians for whom that's not true, but who I still... Like somebody like maybe Flying Lotus, right, who I love. If you play a Flying Lotus song on the guitar, like it may be really cool, but it's not the song. And I don't think you can necessarily judge a song in a one particular setting to another, but I do think that the songs in my personal life that other people have written that I love, and also from my own catalogue, that last the longest in the circuitry of playing gigs and thinking about music, are the songs that can survive many different outfits, you know. because I'm inspired to want to grow with them. You know, the songs have different stages. You know, you have the gestation of the idea, the sort of curation of the themes, and then you have the actual song, and then you have the recording of the song. So you're playing all the instruments and then mixing the song, mastering the song, releasing the song, campaign for the song.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
And then then the song's life really begins, because then it's like the song with the audience, the song in the show, the song in people's lives. And so I think the best songs lend themselves to many different kinds of people's lives. But I don't think necessarily that you have to take, like, taking all the elements out will serve every song better. But I do think that Little Blue for me, for example, is one of the best songs I've ever written, because I know that I can play it on the guitar next to a campfire and on the piano at the Hollywood Bowl, and I can listen to the record of it, and I arranged it for orchestra as well. So it's like, it will survive, and that gives me faith in the song a little bit.
It's a beautiful story.
Thank you. Yeah.
When you're working on a project that's not yours, right? Mm. Like, you worked with Chris Martin and Coldplay.
Yeah.
But you're not featured on every record, right?
Right.
Like, you were part of the larger body of work.
Yeah.
What are you bringing to that room, and how is it different? Like, and what role in the room do you take?
It's such an interesting question. I've thought a lot about this. I found myself, for whatever reason, in all these very interesting rooms at the highest echelon of pop music.
By the way, like, with the coolest people who believe that music is on this, like, Chris has been on our show a couple times, and like, his belief on music and the universe, and he's there's nobody like him.
There's no one like him. Yeah. And the way he'll pull a song down and be like, it's coming, it's coming. Yeah, it's beautiful. But so Chris reached out to me. Actually, it's crazy. Chris heard a song of mine, a song called Home Is, which is the first song in Jesse Volume 1. And I'm not even singing in that song. It's just Voces 8, this English choral group that I mentioned before. And I wrote this kind of like really open, peaceful, clustery, almost like a madrigal, like a very, very pure choral piece. And Chris found that, of all of the songs I've ever written, he was listening to like an Apple choral chill playlist or something, and he was asleep and he woke up, and he'll tell the story better than me, but I think he was like, he thought I was from the 15th century. He was like, this guy must be some like ancient decrepit guy, you know, it's just like in his grave, like, who wrote this? Anyway, it was me. and so I got this text from him, and it was just like, hey man, I'm Chris, I'm in the band Coldplay. And he always says that a lot, I'm in the band Coldplay. It's like, I know. But you know, he's an amazing guy. And he was just like, look, I'd love to... the first thing he said was, I'd love to sample this song, Home Is. I'd like to sample it for a record that we're making. I said, oh, wow, incredible. But then we ended up hanging out, and then he didn't end up sampling it because we ended up recording a bunch of new stuff together. And, you know, in that particular room, again, it's like, it's a hard thing for me to judge, but I think that in those spaces, in those orbits of people who make these massive, massive records... in a sense, I think the value maybe that I bring to that is my priorities not being about the music being huge, but about the music being huge in a musical sense, in a human sense. So I think the way that I throw paint comes from a different angle. You know, I'll always stretch people a little bit to go a bit crazier. And then people will stretch me to sort of like sometimes just tone down the craziness.
The same way you stretch records when you're going and rearranging something.
For sure. I think it's just like, I didn't decide to do that, but it's just me. I just sort of tend to stretch stuff sometimes.
You need that.
Yeah, I think so. And I also really, really value the groundedness of some of these collaborators. You know, someone like Stormzy as well. Stormzy is just this incredible legend from England. It's like the King of England, kind of. And
that's like an understatement. Yeah, totally.
And I worked on his latest record with him. We worked on this island, OC Island, for a few weeks, and we just lived together and made this record with him. You know, you've got a bunch of people who come from many different walks of life, but kind of under, in some ways, the same roof, you know, producers, singers, beat makers, rappers, all sorts of stuff. And then you got me, and I come from all sorts of other places, you know? Like, I've checked out a lot of classical music, I've checked out a lot of jazz, and I've also just experimented in a deep way with sound and all. So I have a different set of materials, and really, really appreciated the challenge of climbing into a world like Stormzy's and just throwing paint and seeing what happens. So, you know, I try not to walk into those rooms. I haven't done too much of that, but I try not to walk into those rooms assuming myself to be anything. You know, if I walk in being like, hey man, I'm the guy who's going to bring X, then I'm not seeing the picture because I don't know what I'm going to need to be yet. It's like, I don't know the color that the painting is going to need until I'm in the painting. I'm like, oh, I need to be green, you know.
That's really fascinating. And do you do it where you end up on albums? Or because with both Coldplay and with Stormzy, you end up on the whole album, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is somewhat rare.
Yeah, it's a real privilege for me. That it's never up to me, really. I always kind of throw the paint, and then they'll say, "Oh, you know what? I like this for this, and this is right for this, or whatever." But man, I take a lot of those lessons and processes, and take them home, and then apply them to my own music, and that's an amazing way of also just learning and expanding my own craft. You know,
one of the biggest through lines that I'm recognizing here is the purest of intentions behind everything you do.
It's funny. The thing with intention is that you can't plan what's true, right? I often remind myself of that. You can't plan what's true. You have to just open your eyes and look. And so I can't decide to have an intention. My intention will be this. I just have the intention. I can either align with it or not. You know, you are who you are. It's innate. So I think there's also a myth that's been going around. In fact, I've seen a lot of Rick Rubin like interviews, and I think Rick Rubin's awesome, but he says one thing that I disagree with, and The thing that he says is, you know, art is only pure if it's not made for commercial purposes. You know, only then do you have pure art. I fundamentally disagree with that. And I think maybe I come from a different place where I actually needed permission as a kid to realize it's okay to play to the gallery. It's cool to meet people where they are. Because if no one had given me faith that was okay, I would have just been in my own world forever. And I never would have been in these situations. So I think you can absolutely make pure art. In fact, I would say art is maybe even only art if there is a bridge in some way between the thing you're making and the other, whether that other is a version of yourself or an audience or a public. There is an amount of that dance, which is actually really fun. And I think for any musicians who are coming up and being like, oh man, I want to make high art. I want to make art that's high level. It's like meet people then where they are and dance with the expectations of what they're going to expect of you. Because for me, I think some of my best work has been after spending many, many, many years in my own world with no one to tell me what to do. Some of my best work has been when I've had the faith that I can meet someone where they are. And, you know, we were talking earlier on about the algorithm. You can play with it, you know? It's fun. It's like, okay, so this is like many things, like education is another example. This is a bunch of hoops that have been created for me to jump through. And I see that by jumping through them, I'm going to appear to be qualified to certain people. So it's like, rather than stamping my foot or going to hide in a cave, it's like, all right, well, then let me put my attention where my attention is best suited and then be open to anything, you know? Art is anything you want it to be. And I think that the more open people can be about intentions, in a sense, the more pure they become, you know? So purifying the air of art by saying it only lives here or only lives here is actually not to be pure. Because being pure is to be open, you know?
Totally. And let it fall where it may.
Wherever it may, yeah, yeah.
It's so true.
Yeah.
By the way, you can listen to all of Jacob's music. We're going to put a link in the description below, and the whole catalog sits on Amazon Music in very high quality, the right way to consume your art. You know, the way Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and others who really give a shit about the quality of sound.
Mm.
Do you care about that?
Not at all, no.
I didn't think so.
That's the least of my worries.
Yeah. But it is all sitting on Amazon Music. You can click the link in the description below. And just know that like it sounds good. Like sounds better than other places.
Well, I have a question based off that. When you're listening to music, what are you listening for?
Myself, probably, like everyone else.
It's true. And people don't really necessarily admit that. Like, when you do listen to a record, don't you listen to be understood for a certain, to a certain degree?
Yeah. Well, I often think about the fact that, I feel like I'm getting existential now, but like, someone's behavior is only how they feel about themselves. That's how they behave towards you. It's not personal. Nothing's personal. So if I listen to a song, I could be like, I'm listening for the, you know, whatever. I could name a bunch of things I listen for and enjoy listening to, and I love hearing about a person's story. But fundamentally, as a human being, I'm probably just listening for a version of myself that I didn't know I lacked, or didn't know I felt, or didn't know I needed. You know, and so, but also because we are all each other, and if you do something right and you say something right, then there will be part of everyone will be in that, and I love that about music is that you can reflect people. To themselves in a way that is so forgiving or warm or clarifying or challenging, whatever, without having to say it. You can just be it. And then it maybe goes back to the purity thing, but it's like if you do something in a way that's really you, then other people will find themselves. And Joni Mitchell actually once said this. I don't know if you've seen this. She did an interview maybe about 15 years ago. She was talking about lyrics, and I think someone asked her, like, you know, what are the best lyrics? And she says something, I mean, I'm going to, you know, dreadfully paraphrase it, but she says something along the lines of, you know, if I write a song about me, for me, and people only just see me in the song, then I've failed as a songwriter. But if I write a song, it could be about anything in the world, and people see themselves, that's a song that will be a companion to them for the rest of their lives, and that's a good song. And I really think that's beautiful and true, and I think it goes for all kinds of things in art and also in life, in a sense. It's like if you present something only for yourself or of yourself, then that doesn't necessarily go anywhere. Though sometimes being yourself can transmit very far. But I've been thinking a lot recently about, you know, vulnerability, this big word vulnerability, and it's like a buzzword on social media in a strange, subversive way. Like, hey man, be vulnerable, overshare, you know. But I don't think being vulnerable is about oversharing. In fact, in songwriting, I don't think you need to even talk from your own perspective to be vulnerable. Sometimes the most vulnerable songs are written from other people's perspectives, but they're written in a way where it's really how you see the world. Like, the job of an artist is to express the world exactly as they see it. There's nothing else that an artist is here to do. An artist isn't here to make work that other people need them or want them to make. But by saying, I see this, I mean, talk about permission. It's like, then people of this world who do see things like that or on the edge of it, then they are given faith that they too can see that. So I think, yeah, going back to the questions, like when I listen to music, I mean, you know, there's many different versions of my brain that will attend to different parts of the garden or whatever. Like, oh, I see that there's this. Oh, I feel this. Oh, I see it. Oh, what an interesting choice. Oh, how is this? You know, there's all these things going on, as with all of us in the whole world. But fundamentally, I think I'm just looking for a version of an incarnation of my own humanity that I can connect with, you know.
So basic at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. So we're basic creatures. We're basically plants, you know.
It's true.
Yeah.
And the God truth is, like, we all are just different versions of one another.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a beautiful thing and something that we forget so often.
Yeah.
And very few things remind us of that.
But music's one of them.
100%.
Yeah.
And it is genuinely a universal language in a way that, like, one can't even comprehend. I mean,
it's wild. And it goes back to the inheritance of some of these things, you know, rhythm being in the body, melody being in the voice. Since the dawn of time, we've been experimenting with these things. But, you know, one of the things that I've come to find and feel with the audience choir is it's just this thing. It's like everyone knows. You always know more than you think you know. Just follow, you know. And within you is this inherent understanding of music, not because you went to conservatoire, but because you listened to music for your whole life. Like, everyone's listened to music for their whole life. You know about major and minor. I don't have to sit down and give you a textbook. Like, you know it. And in the same way that you know my body language, like, you know what this means. No one's taught you it, but you know because you've been absorbing it. So I think with music, it's that to a high level. I've come to realize it's like people do know. You do know, you know?
Who is Jesse? Is it a real person or is it just a vessel?
Yeah, it's a mixture, really. It's not really a real person. Like, when I was a kid, people used to call me JC. It's like my nickname, Jacob Collier, JC. And so Jesse became a kind of like shorthand version of that. In terms of the album, I wanted to forge a character of sorts that was partly me and also partly the other, that would sort of reflect the journey that I was about to embark on. I didn't know what the journey was going to be back then, but it's like, okay, Jesse, go ahead, go off on your travels and, you know. Sick. And so, yeah, that kind of became the main character of the, but it's not like
a version of you,
a dude or something. It's more like, yeah, it's like an idea. Sometimes I think of it as like me as a 10-year-old boy, you know. I don't know if you guys ever think about being different ages, like constantly at one time being many different ages and different ages having different connective like vibrations at different times, but I felt 10 years old quite a lot recently. It's such a crazy age, 10. 10's wild, you know.
Can you explain that to me? What do you like? Are you waking up feeling 10? Do you have moments where you feel 10?
I just have
10?
Moments. Like when I zone out, I'm like, oh, I'm really 10 right now, you know?
What do you see? What do you feel?
I think there's like a sort of lucidity and deflection.
Totally.
About it. Like when you're 10, you don't really, it's like before you get self-conscious and you're like, are you looking at me? But you're kind of like in your own world, but you're also aware of the world. So when I was 10, I'm like awake to everything. But I kind of just like in my own thing, you know? And then like I can hang, but most of all I'm just gonna be in my world. You know, yeah. I've noticed like a resonance with that age. I don't know, maybe it's like an imaginary thing, but it's kind of amazing how you carry all those years with you all the time. And sometimes I just find myself aligning with one age, like, wow, I'm really 23, like I'm now 29, but like I'm really 23 today, you know? It's weird.
So do you get different music on different, based on different ages?
Sometimes, yeah. I'll get a different flow. And from that flow, you can get different music, different ideas, different ways of speaking, different kinds of dreams. You know what I mean? It's just like life changes its hue, its flavor, depending on like, yeah, who you connect with and who you are on that day. I think a lot about like internal weather. Like, you know, you wake up on any given day and there's like a set of forces at play.
Totally.
So it's like on one day you might be like super hungry, but you can't laugh. Or like another day you might like be hysterically laughing, but you're like not hungry at all. You know, all these different metrics of things that can change. I just think it's very interesting to be a human. You sit and look around like, wow, what an amazing firework display. You know, I'm alive. Wow. You know,
it's overstimulating. It's a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And you control where to put your attention. And I've just noticed myself recently be like, wow, I feel like I did when I was X, or I feel... this feels interesting or this feels interesting, and you follow it. And
see, you follow it. Some people just like feel those things and let them go.
Well, it's my job to follow it as an artist, really. Like, especially on stage. Like last year I toured the world, and in every show of the tour, I improvised a rendition of a song at the piano that I'd never played before, like never even rehearsed. So I'd be like, right, I'm going to play like You Can Close Your Eyes by James Taylor, or I'm going to play like Samson by Regina Spektor or whatever. And these songs I would just, it's just improvised. I hadn't planned the key. I'd learned the words. I was so bad with words. I learned the words. But my job in that moment is not to like perform the rendition of the song that I'd figured out. It's to be like, okay, well, what's the weather today? And normally after three notes, I'm like, whoa, oh, I see. This is how I'm feeling. Oh, right. I need a, like, I'm actually kind of sad. Or I'm really tired. Or like, whoa, I'm supercharged, or I'm centered and calm today, or I'm like super magnetic today. All these things, as I play and improvise, I learn who I am.
Realizations that you wouldn't have had.
Yeah, and that's what music can give you, is those realizations. It's crazy.
Do you see colors when you make music at all? Or like, is that not in your, like, because based on your outfits, colors matter. Patterns matter.
Colors matter. I don't see literal colors like, oh, this is blue, this is purple so much. I know people who do, and it's a very amazing and valid experience, but I think there's definitely some kind of routing of circuitry that does merge parts of my experience that aren't musical with music. I think language is probably one of them, just like the use of words and I just love language a lot, and I've always loved all languages and learning them and playing with them and things like that. But I think that there's that gets mixed up. So for example, if I play a chord, I could say, okay, this is like the rope of a boat. Like a rope that you'd find on a boat, or this is like it's like this is like a broken bell, or this is like a beard or something, you know. But because I think there are just, my mind is quite associative, and so one experience will be will be viscerally in line with another. But I don't have sort of traditional synesthesia in that sense, or kind of like Brown. You know, I also think that one note can be many different things. So like, you know, for example, if you play an A in D major, that's a very different feeling from if you play an A in chord of F major. It's like a different hue. It's like a different universe. So the thought that that A would be the same color doesn't make sense to me in a literal sense, though I'm sure if you spoke to someone who really had this experience, they'd be able to explain why and how that works, you know.
What do you think?
What is something, when it comes to making music, like what is something you would want to get better at or you think you need to improve on?
Writing songs. I want to write better songs. I've spent a lot of my life making worlds, you know, or enhancing songs, decorating songs, orchestrating, arranging, painting. I'm always so relieved when I have the song. I'm like, okay, great, I've got the song. Now I can actually like do my real work, you know. But I'd like to get better as a songwriter. I feel like I'm only just getting started, and I want to expand my perspectives and my vocabulary for being concise and being clear and challenging things. And there's a number of areas that, I mean, there's in every way really. But I think if I take it at face value, like as a songwriter, I'd love to deepen my craft. I think that would sort of make space or give way to other kinds of growth that I'd be excited to do too, you know.
How do you get there?
You have to just do it enough.
Right? That's the trick.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. I've been making this album for a while, but I don't have very much time to write songs because there's so many other things to do all the time. I mean, this is the story of an artist in 2023, really. It's like there's constantly things to give attention to, and they're all interesting. So it's hard to prioritize. But actual songwriting ends up being kind of shoehorned a little bit in my life. It's like, okay, I'll write a song, and then I have to go and go on tour. Or I have to go and make a social media post, or go travel, and I've got to do it. And I love all of it. But I think at some point in my life, I want to just sort of like, so yeah, hunker down and just really go deep in that craft, and also just write songs with people I really respect as songwriters, you know. Which is in some ways a different world from artists. You know, lots of my favorite artists are my favorite songwriters, but the real craftsman of songmanship or songwomanship is a whole world of its own. And I'd like to go there.
It is really interesting because I don't think there's any two incredible iconic songs that sound alike.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And some are really literal, some are
totally abstract,
detailed, or some are abstract. Yeah. It's like when you really think about it, right? Like, I mean, I think about like, okay, so what do I love about Joni Mitchell? What do I love about Neil Young? I love their deep sense of detail.
Mm.
I love the fact that they're on the nose, but also not on the nose.
That's the magical
thing. How do you learn that?
You have to go to both places fully. You have to go full abstract. You have to go full literal. And then you have to whittle those together into like this golden alchemy. And you just try again and again and again. And then gradually you maybe get closer to the thing, you know, but it's funny. I think a lot of education and the way that we are designed to think is based in fear. You know, it's like, don't do that. And even less is more, actually. It's like, oh, don't do that. No, that's inappropriate. Or you can't go there. Or, no one's ever done that, so you probably can't. You know, sure. I think the thing with art that makes it so valuable in this world right now is that art is a place where you can explore the most extreme feelings in the world safely. And not just safely, in a way that helps other people feel that stuff too. So, like, and same is true for, you know, people who write stories, people who script films. You're making worlds. You can go to the extremes. Go to the extremes. You know, go to make the craziest music you can possibly imagine, and then go 10 times crazy. You know, go there. Like, go to the edge. Why are we here if not to do that? To explore that, and then try and go to the simplest, most eloquent, clarifying, bog standard thing you can possibly imagine too. They're all valid. Like, play with everything, throw all the paint. Don't try and judge an idea as it's coming out, like a teacher slapping someone's hand. Don't play that, you know. It's like, well, let me play it and learn that I may not choose that note. Or maybe I actually do want to choose that note. Like, there's literally no right and wrong. There's just no right and wrong. You can do whatever you want. There's no one right perspective. And as a songwriter, you can't be told, hey man, you know, you should really write more literal. This is too out there. Or, hey, you know, this is just like on the nose. You should really think about like stretching. Literally, you decide as a songwriter what's right for you. And that's kind of amazing. And yeah, for me, I love both those extremes in a deep way. And I'm consistently trying to find those bridges between, you could say, the abstract and the literal, or the simple and the complex, or the the kind of the surface and the depth, or young and the old, or all these different things, the big and the small. Yeah, there's constantly ways of bridging this stuff, but you have to figure out for yourself, in a sense.
Whose ears do you trust to give you, I mean, to just play something for before it gets touched by the public?
I mean, my mum is probably the first person that comes to mind.
Who played with you the other night? She's incredible.
She was in town. Yeah, she's unbelievable. I mean, she just knows me through and through. So if I play her something that, and the thing is, like, you know, she's not going to say like, oh man, I don't know about that, like, F-6 chord. Are you sure that you should have the six? she'll be like, is this you? You know, does this feel like you? And she'll hear the me in it or not. And that's a metric that kind of only she can give in that way. It's like, this, is this faithful to your, to the way you see the world? And sometimes I can't tell, you know, because I'm biased. I made the thing and I like the thing. I made the thing. Don't challenge me, you know. But I think that her perspective of saying, okay, this is how I hear it, or you know, and she'll also totally hang musically. She'll be like, I don't know if you need the B section. Actually, you should half the length of it. Or do you really need to linger on this section? You know, things like this. But I don't know, sometimes the most qualified people to give me feedback are the least qualified musicians.
Totally.
Because musicians just kind of like have their own thing going on.
Yeah, and it's fueled by whatever.
It's fueled by the mind sometimes, but you know, like, you know, play music to like a 2-year-old, see if they jiggle their feet, you know.
It's actually the best barometer.
Yeah, it's like, okay, this is a vibe then. Or no, it's not, you know. Because children just can't lie. They don't lie. They just experience stuff. And so that's kind of an interesting premise.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, it is really true. The most qualified are the most unqualified people.
Well, not only to listen, but to make. Totally. To make music too.
Really?
Oh yeah. I mean, you think, at what point are you qualified enough to start making music? Is anyone qualified to start? Never, you know? You're qualified to start making music when it interests you so much that you can't not do it.
Yeah, when you're passionate and pushed to do it.
When you're pulled to, you're like, I find myself doing this, I must, you know? But also it takes time to build up your confidence, and like, there's no such thing as being qualified to begin. You just have to start somewhere. And that's, I think there's a myth there. I think people think, right, I have to sort of study, or, you know, get this, or, and even when you're fully qualified, you could say as an artist, even then it's like, well, I need to win a Grammy, or I need to go on TV or play a late night TV show or collaborate with a big artist, like it to feel like I can start.
Totally.
Feeling like I'm, it's crazy, you know.
And by the way, I've seen that like in recent years, more and more.
Well, yeah, because the currency is of these kind of, these communication forms that are based in, hey man, what's hot, you know?
Yeah, and totally.
And
like,
I understand that, but it's
shallow, hollow stuff. And by the way, these are artists that are selling out for 10,000 people on any given night in any city in America.
Yeah.
And they're like, I need a Grammy. I need to be on Jimmy Fallon. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. It's interesting premise, and you know, you can't take any of these things lightly. And it's the same as what we were saying earlier on. It's like everyone, no matter who you are, everyone's going to be insecure in certain ways. Everyone's going to have certain holes and gaps and things like that. But you're always qualified to make a statement, no matter what position you're in. And these ideas that once I get this, let me just get this one thing, then I'll be cool, then I'll be ready, then I'll be happy, then I'll be. It's just, you know, I mean, there's thousands of years of literature here, but it's like it's not true. It doesn't work, you know, and the simplest things in life are the most important often, and that's not to say all these things aren't fun, because they're also super fun. You can play in these fields, but the moment you attach yourself to one thing, and like, I'm guilty of this too, like, I totally know the feeling of being like, this is what matters, I need this one thing, if I don't get this one thing, what am I, I'm you know,
what was that for you?
I mean, there's so many examples. As a musician, I think for a while it was like, you know, do I know the craziest chords, you know, can I play the fastest, I know everyone goes through a period of their life where, you know, you kind of like are grinding in that way. And I don't subscribe. And also I'm grateful for that time, because, you know, when you're competing and in that zone, you do end up developing skills that you probably wouldn't if you were just in silo. Like, I do want to be the best. I want to be the best at this. You know, I want to go the deepest. I want to understand the biggest. And, but then you realize that, you know, the things that I find the most interesting or moving as a listener aren't the things that are born out of those psychologies. They can freak me in a cool way, like, whoa, you know, but are they going to live with me for the rest of my life? That's a different question, you know?
And the answer is, nah.
The answer is, it depends. I think sometimes things that come from a crazy place of catharsis can be really, really important to listen to. but not like things that are made cerebrally or things that are made to fit into something, you know, like this must conform it directly with this one thing. I don't find myself drawn to those things particularly. And I don't find myself enjoying the work I make from that, you know, perspective either. But it's fun to play with that.
You have 5 Grammys.
Mm.
What do they mean to you?
Well, they have different notes. So they sound great. you know, I think it's taken me a while to sort of know where to put them in a sense, like not literally because they like, live on my Wurlitzer, but like in my mind. Because, you know, when I made In My Room and I won 2 Grammys, it was this thing of kind of like, I just never imagined myself as being a person who would be in those circles. And you have to kind of come to terms with that a little bit. And, you know, and when I was up for Album of the Year in 2021, and that was, it was honestly challenging because it's kind of like it was the first time I thought of myself as needing to have something to say or needing to represent certain things. And I found it really hard to create music for a little while after that because it was just kind of like this thing that carries with us water. But the Grammys are, you know, they are made up. Like someone made them up. Like they don't exist. It's not real. It's like someone was like, let's make up the Grammys and like have people get nominated. And, you know, wouldn't that be fun? And it's amazing. And I'm so, so, so grateful for the doors that the Grammys have opened for me. And I also really value the Grammys as a forum of awards that are voted on by actually people who make work, like people who make music, I love and respect. I think they are making efforts to keep that group diverse, to keep it conversational, flexible, evolving with the times. You can never get that right, really, 100%. But I think that they do a lot. They do a lot more work than many other institutions that I see and award shows that I see in having creative integrity, you know. And so I think to be recognized by that group of people means a whole lot to me because that's kind of all I care about. It's like, oh yeah, let's make cool things together. And you know, it's kind of funny how you know you win a Grammy and suddenly people pay attention to you in a way when the work hasn't changed, but the reality of what that work means or where it sits has changed. But you know, we're human, and I get it. Like we come up with things like this, and I feel really really lucky to be counted into the number, and never take it too seriously because it's not really real after all, but I'm grateful for what it's, you know, what it's done for me. It's so funny, you know, I never won a talent contest or I'd never won anything. Like I never won a competition or a prize or anything like that until I won my first Grammy. You know, it's like, because a lot of these contests are rigged in favor of all sorts of different kinds of people. And
totally.
For whatever reason, I think I was just making the right kind of music to appeal to the right kind of people at the right time. I get lucky, you know.
When you're doing a choral arrangement, do you like, what do you hear? Do you hear it in your head and then you're able to write it out or?
Well, I used to write things out, but now I don't write anything out anymore unless other people are going to perform it. So
see,
if I arrange a song like say Moon River, like I arrange Moon River and that is just, I imagine an experience I want to go on. Like, right, I'm going to take this song on a crazy journey. I remember with Moon River, I was like, I want to go to a key that doesn't exist. That was like one of the things I wanted to do. And I actually did. I went to the key of D half sharp major for the last chorus. So
that was the goal.
It was one of the things I wanted to try because a key that doesn't exist on the piano, I mean, all keys exist, but the piano only has 12 keys. And everyone's like, man, there's only 12 keys, man. It's the same 12 keys. It's just not true. There's infinite keys. You can go anywhere you want. And so in Moon River, I wanted to go to this key that was like I'd never heard before because I wanted to feel what that felt like. And it feels insane to go to a key that you've never heard before, especially if you start like, I started that song in B flat, like classic B flat, staple key, one of my favorites. And to end in this like crazy, you know, in this other place is just, yeah, it's wild. I just wanted to go on a big extravaganza. I don't necessarily hear it all or see it all in my head, but I'll sketch it out on the piano. I'll sketch out with MIDI first, and then I'll kind of just, you start painting. It could be a kind of painstaking process in a sense, but I don't say that with any kind of suffering it implied. It's kind of like careful, patient process of every single note just has to be sung. Thousands and thousands of voices and notes have to be sung. So you go and do it. And it's like one of my most contented states is doing a vocal arrangement of a song or composition with voices. It's like I go into a zone and I'm like Bob Ross, you know, just kind of going in, making shapes. I see we need a hill here. Lovely. You know, let's make some rain. And I feel like that when I'm in that zone. I'm like, let me, but I'm not saying it out loud, but I'm thinking, I'm feeling it like, yeah, I think, oh, this one. And I really, really like that process a lot.
All connected to feeling.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
All of Jacob's music, by the way, sitting, waiting for you on Amazon Music. Link in the description below. You have a line of Crocs. Mazel tov.
That's true.
It's huge.
My dream has come true.
How many pairs of the yellow ones do you own?
Maybe three.
Oh, that's reasonable.
These get dirty. These get really dirty because, I mean, they're filthy. You can see them out. There's dirt all over them. I wore these on stage at the Hollywood Bowl. That's why they're so dirty.
They're good. Good pair.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, they're bright and vivid. But
no gibbets.
In total, I probably have like 20 pairs of Crocs or so in my life. That's like kind of a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, because that's the shoe you won't is exclusively wear?
Well, I just like wearing them. I don't have an exclusive deal or anything, but since I was, when did Crocs come out? Like 2004?
Yeah, something like that.
I remember like that year I was, my whole family were rocking Crocs, much to the intense derision of those around us. Like, what are you wearing? What is this ridiculous? I'm so here for the Renaissance, man. I love it. Everyone's rocking Crocs now.
Early adopter.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I designed my own Crocs like a few months ago and they came out and they came around. I released a song called Well, and it was in and around that song that I launched a line of Crocs. I made this video like with everything inside this crazy Croc. It was fun. But yeah, I'm a staunch Croc believer for sure.
Respect.
I'm into it.
I'm a Boston Clog Birkenstock guy.
Okay, fair.
Yeah. So similar in intent and in clogness and in comfort.
Yeah. Comfort's the thing, isn't it?
That's where I live.
Yeah.
And I only wear them. Like it's, I almost exclusively wear them. No deal or anything, but like it's, yeah.
I'm here for it. Totally here for
it. Shoes make my feet feel like they're in a prison cell.
Yeah.
And I don't like that.
But I'm going to steal that line.
It's all yours. Yeah,
thanks.
What are you thinking?
Jesse Volume 4 comes out on February 29th, which is a leap year.
Yeah.
You do that on purpose?
Yeah. Well, it's Volume 4, right? Once every 4 years.
There you go.
Just feels like it landed in the right place.
It did.
Yeah.
But it's not done yet.
No, I need to go finish it. I need to go like finish it in a second, actually. This afternoon, I got to go do some work.
That's crazy. I mean, like, will you be working up until, when's your deadline?
Well,
I mean, you have a date
I think I'm delivering the album in a few weeks' time. So now it's just like the crazy last 10% of the album. It's just like you guys must know this feeling when you've been working for a long time on something, a big piece of work, and it's like final stages, and it's like, and the thing about that time is, you know, you go in with a plan, but then things come from the side. Like I didn't see certain things coming. Like I've got a session today with a musician who I'd never thought would be on this album, and he's going to be on the album hopefully, and it's just wild. It's like,
would we know him?
Camilo.
Oh wow.
You know Camilo?
Sick.
Just awesome, awesome guy. And I've been a fan of his for a while. And, you know, like last minute, like Camilo's coming into town. Wow, you know? So it's like I always have to keep my eyes open and ears open for the last minute. These curveballs come in and, you know, it's like, it's exciting. It's a time of chaos. It's a time of chaos.
Does the story feel like it's finished now? Like after this volume four is done, does the whole story feel like it's wrapped up?
Yeah, I think Jesse as a journey is like, that's a wrap. Okay. I can't do a volume five. I would kill me, you know. I mean, I've got like three albums of songs that haven't made volume four that I could easily release, but I don't know what's gonna happen with those songs. I think I need to do something different next and pour something that's scaled down. Like this is like the most ambitious album I can ever imagine. It's so ambitious. It's like, you know, it's such an undertaking. And so I think after this, I mean, I'll tour it next year and it's gonna be freaking so exciting, but after that I think I need to do something more chill.
Last question I have off that is, do you think there's some people who just won't understand it?
Yeah, I don't need people to understand it. I'd like people to feel it in some way. And I don't think you need to understand anything to feel it. There may be some people who are just like, I can't feel this at all. Like, fair enough, you know?
Yeah.
But I would hope there's something for everybody on this album. I really believe there is. And even there's something of everybody. I mean, I recorded every audience choir of last year's tour. I recorded for the album, 150,000 voice choir on the album. The sound is like nothing you've ever heard. It's like this massive, massive, massive sound. So the album ends and begins in this like, yeah, 100,000 voice choir. And and it's a sound I've never heard before. And so it's made of people, you know? So it's like, even if you can't get down with the principles of it or you don't like that, whatever, it's like there's something in it that is just made of people. And I really love that, and it reminds me of what's important in the music. And so funny, I embarked on, as I was saying, I embarked on this journey. You know, I began my career layering my own voice on top of itself in a little room in London with an SM58 microphone, trying to be a choir, one little kid trying to be a huge choir, make an album by myself, do this collaborative album. And I'm thinking, I want to be collaborative. What's the biggest form of collaboration I can imagine? And I end up with this 100,000 voice audience choir on my record. And I can't help but smile at that full circle. You know, it's like, it's the thing I was trying to be 10 years ago, but on the biggest, in a bigger scale that I could ever dream of. You know, this huge sound, this massive, the whole world, like every, you know, we did what, 90, we did 91 gigs last year in something like, I think close to 40 countries of the world. That's a lot of people from different walks of life. That's a lot of individual stories that have led to that voice of theirs coming out, joining together. It's a lot of strangers meeting for the first time in a musical setting. It's a lot of catharsis and joy and connectivity. And those principles, I just find to be, like, I can't, you can't look away from that in 2023. We need that stuff. We need to be connective. We need to be joyous. We need to remember why we're here, which is to connect and to love each other and have fun and to be fearless and to give each other permission and to just throw all the paint. And to me, if there's anything worth celebrating right now, it's that, like more than ever. And if I look back at Jacob age, you know, 19, starting out, it's like, wow, I really found the thing that I was chasing. I didn't know I was chasing it, but I really found the thing that I was chasing with that one microphone all those years ago in all these people's voices. And one thing I really feel is like my voice, you think you talk a lot as an artist, how do I find my voice? What's my voice? It's like, maybe my voice is just only ever as big and as strong as other people's voices, the people's voices that are around me, you know? And that's the thing that I've learned most of all in all this process.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Whether it's with all these different collaborators, artists, orchestras, choirs, rappers, trappers, fiddlers, pipers, everything, to the voice of the whole world, the audience choir, it's like, if I'm strengthening those voices, if I'm empowering those voices to be not who I want them to be, but to be themselves,
you do the same.
That's what music's about, you know?
Totally. Dude, that made me emotional.
Me too.
It's true.
Yeah.
You have such a beautiful perspective on music, but on people.
Oh, thank you.
And that is so vital.
I think it is. And I also think music people are the same thing totally. If they're done right. It's the same language.
And people really forget that. I think if you look at history, I love history. I think you can learn from the past to understand where we're going.
Yeah.
Music has this ability to bring people together in ways that, like, you can't even really fully comprehend and historically have done so. I think, you know, as we go into another election cycle and we go into a whole, every day is something new.
Yeah.
My hope and my want is that music remains that pillar that just, I don't know, just brings people together in a way that, like, nothing else can. Like, yeah, movies can, but music is different. Like, you go into music, to your point, looking to understand yourself and fill holes within you.
Yeah, you go into to meet yourself there, and you can, and you do. And one thing I think I've learned as a performer, as songwriter, and as a musician in general, as a humanist, is like, expect the best from people, you know? Like, expect love. You will perceive what you expect to, like, you'll find what you're looking for. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. You'll find what you're looking for. If you look for fear in the world, it's everywhere. It is everywhere. If you look for love in the world, it's everywhere, everywhere, in everything, even in the fear. People love so much, they freak out, they close down. There's love everywhere you look. And it sounds so simple, but it's so true. It's like, if you expect to see a loving world, you will see one. And if you expect to see a world that's terrified, polarized, confused, conflicted, in constant crisis, then that's what you'll see, because that's also going on. You can believe anything. You can literally believe anything. So comes back to, what do you want to believe, you know? And it's like, you can choose to believe in love, and it's always there. And that's huge. That's like a big thing to remember. And as a musician, it's like something that you can actively choose to purvey, you know,
totally.
Connectivity and love. And It's why I take my job so seriously, in a sense, you know?
You should. And by the way, like, to just go full circle again, it's also about permission. I think a lot of people don't feel they have the permission to see that, right?
Yeah.
Because they're hit with the other everywhere and anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Jacob Collier's music is waiting for you. Link in the description below. Final thoughts?
I think we covered a lot here.
You are one of the greatest guests we've ever had on our couch.
Wow. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks for having me, honestly. It's been awesome.
Hopefully you will come back.
I'd love that.
You are absolutely incredible. And education matters to you. And teaching people matters to you because it's the way this thing keeps going, correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's like everyone. I'm like my mom in so many ways, whether I like it or not. And my mom is a very gifted teacher and educator. And so,
so
I think I grew up in the world being like, maybe I wouldn't call myself a teacher, but it's definitely part of my fascination. I love explaining this stuff. It's like, it's so interesting. And I learn by... Every time I try to explain something like this, I'm learning as well. Like, I'm improving my own sense of things and all that stuff. So yeah, let's keep passing it on. It's like, that's what we're here to do, you know?
You are so beautifully articulate. And by having these discussions, to learn new things yourself keeps it fresh. And I don't know, it's really fucking awesome.
I really appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
You are, one in a trillion, all of his music. Jacob Collier, waiting for you on Amazon Music. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Jacob Collier, everybody.
Thank you.